Harris back to pass. Looks end zone. Has his man. Has the touchdown. Terrence Tolliver. Got a shot here. Did he make it? Yes, he did. What a catch. Oh, my. Luke Tasker touchdown.
Welcome to Podski Weewee. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham.
All right, Mike. We have got a jam-packed show today, so let's, you know, get no chit-chat for us this week. We got to get right into the news because since the last time we sat down, which unfortunately was way too long ago due to a certain illness on my part that didn't allow me to record when we wanted to, Tommy Condell has resigned as the Hamilton Ticats offensive coordinator. I don't know about you, but this took me completely by surprise.
Yeah, I was shocked to hear that news. Was just, you know, made me fall off my chair, to be frank. I mean, this guy's been with Austin for, you know, his full time in Hamilton, and when he was where was the university they're at?
Oh my God, I'm drawing a blank too. It's my God.
I was gonna say the University of Condell.
No, but, right? Cornell.
Yeah, there you go. It's kind of like Condell.
Yes.
So they've been together for a while. You know, came out of the blue. You know, they were just right before, you know, the season gets started. Really, mini camps starting today, and yeah, it was a shock. You know, you got to ask yourself if Ken Austin's going to call the plays now, if they're going to bring in an offensive coordinator. You know, what are they going to do with that spot? You know, he's done a great job over the years with the Ticats. You know, the offense has really been clicking, especially last year when Claros was healthy. So it's a tough loss for sure. I know that Claris was really tight with Condell. They had a really good relationship, so that's going to be tough. So, yeah, it's just going to be interesting to see what they do going forward, and he will be missed.
Do you think that they will bring in an offensive coordinator? Because personally, I don't think they will. This is the Austin Condell offense. They built this together. Like you said, they've been together for many years. And Austin is an offensive guy. He's been an offensive coordinator in the CFL before with both Toronto, where he won a Grey Cup in 2004, and I believe he was also an offensive coordinator with the Ottawa Renegades. So he has experience calling plays. I know this will be an added job title that he takes on, but he just recently shed himself with the GM title, so this kind of frees him up to maybe do this. And I think bringing in an offensive coordinator at this point, unless it's someone that is intimately familiar with Austin and Condell's system, it doesn't really make a whole bunch of sense. You're not going to change the offense where, as we sit now in late April, less than 2 months before the start of the season, you're not going to come in and change the terminology and all that stuff on the guys. So I really think that it's going to be Austin calling the shots. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. It'd just be such a smooth transition from Condell calling the plays to Austin calling the plays because it's their offense. So I think it's too late to bring in an offensive coordinator. You know, why bother? You know, Austin's done it before. He can do it again. And I think you're just on offense if Austin takes over the realms of calling the plays. And I think he'll do a great job. I don't think it'll be too much responsibilities on his shoulders. I think he'll be fine, you know, maybe just for this year. And maybe next year they bring in an offensive coordinator to take over that role. But for this year, I think it's going to be Austin.
Yeah, I think my only concern is that it will take away from Austin doing the head coaching stuff on game day, because I've seen it where the offense comes onto the field and he starts talking to some of the defensive guys and vice versa. The defense is on the field, he talks to the offensive guys, but still sort of pays attention to the whole framework of the team. He's going to be taken away from that if he's calling plays. He's going to be more offensive focused. Maybe this is something that allows Orlando Steinhauer to take even more responsibility on, maybe something he's looking forward to, showing that he can do a little bit more. I do think this hurts the team simply because of how close to the season this resignation occurred. And one of the big things the Ticats have had the last few years that has allowed them to be in the Grey Cup conversation, regardless of player injuries or roster turnover or what have you, is they had this coaching continuity. They've had the same coordinators ever since Austin's been here, and now that's completely thrown into disarray with this very late resignation on Condell's part. I think that could play a role. Again, you know, we have the injury to Zach Caleros, and now we have this coaching turmoil a little bit. I think we could probably see, unfortunately, the Ticats maybe get off to a little bit of a slow start in 2016.
Yeah, it's a possibility, and like you were talking about Steiner, maybe it's just like he steps into kind of a assistant head coach role, maybe not officially, but he takes on more responsibility with Condell leaving. That could be a, you know, a big possibility. So yeah, you're right. It might be tough with Caleros' injury and this coaching shuffle going on, this coaching change. But, you know, I think they'll be, it might be a little bit of a rocky start, but once they get used to it, I think they'll start rocking and rolling and put some wins together. But yeah, it could be one of those typical Ticats starts in the, you know, we've seen in the past years where it's a 1-3 start, 1-4. Hopefully it's not that way, but yeah, it could be a tough start for the Ticats this season.
Yeah, and like I said, it's just tough to lose a coach of this caliber, or a coach of any caliber, this close to the start of the season. That is bound to have ramifications throughout the season. But like you said, Austin knows what he's doing. This is his system. They'll find a way to figure this out. This is not anything new. Like, yeah, it's a different type of adversity, but this team has been dealing with adversity pretty much since Austin took over the job. There was the year in Guelph. There was the stadium delays. Then there was the injury to Caleros last year. Like, there's always something. Like, players have been getting hurt left, right, and center on this team. They've always found a way to stay in the mix. Just another, the latest in the long line of adversity to strike this team. And I'm sure they'll find a way to not use it as an excuse for any poor play and find a way to just build up off of this and still find a way to be in the hunt at the end of the season.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is kind of like, yeah, I mean, it's a big deal, but it's in the big scope of things over the last couple of years, it's not as huge as some of the other problems that we've had with the Ticats and the organization, you know, with all the difficulties. So, you know, they'll get over it and they'll be fine.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to minimize the impact of this, because this is big. Like, for a team to lose one of their coordinators this close to the start of the season, I cannot stress that enough. That is a major, major loss. But the goodwill, the trust that this team and this coaching staff has gotten from the fans and from you and I in particular over the last couple of seasons makes me less worried than I may have been if this would have happened, say, back when Marcel Belfay was the head coach. And he would, then I probably would have been a little more, well, you know, the team's always kind of hovering around 500 and now they've lost their coach. I don't know how this is going to go. This team under Austin stewardship, I'm a little more confident can overcome this because we've seen them overcome so much.
Totally different situation, totally different, you know, vibe, totally different organization than it was back, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. This team is a great team, and they're gonna rise above adversity just because of how much confidence I have in Austin and his coaching staff and the higher ups in management. This team is gonna be fine. We're gonna be in the hunt for another championship, I believe, this year. So, yeah, though this is a big loss, but they'll get over it.
So, moving on to some more Ticats news, they re-signed and extended and brought in a ton of players. You brought up minicamp starting today. As we sit down and record this on April 26th, minicamp has started today. So, they've brought in a bunch of players, but the biggest name of all that they have gotten, whose name they've gotten on a contract, is they inked Peter Diakowski to a contract extension, which keeps that interior Canadian offensive line of Bomben, Diakowski, and Filer all together for the next couple of seasons. More continuity on the offensive line, I think, breeds a better offense. I don't think we can diminish what the offensive line means to a coherent and impressive offense. And this is, to me, is just it was a no-brainer to ink him up again. He's now the longest-serving Ticat by a mile, and he's a likable guy. I'm just glad that he's back.
Yeah, he's you know, when Marwan Hage left the team, I believe that Diakowski became the leader on that offensive line. He's, like you said, the longest standing Ticat now. So it's great to have him back with the other two Canadians locked up for a couple more years on that offensive line. Like you said, the offensive line is, to me, it's everything for the offense. If the offensive line isn't great, then the offense isn't going to be great either. The Caleros has to have time back there. The receivers have to have time to run their routes to get open. If they don't have time, then the offense is nothing. So to have these guys back for a couple more years, you know, the continuity, like you said, is great. They also signed Olsen this week, so another guy coming back, and they got Simmons back, you know, a couple months ago. So I think they have pretty good depth on that offensive line, and it's great to see, because, you know, we have to protect Caleros. Caleros is everything. So if he's upright, if he has time to throw the ball, then this offense is going to be just as good, if not better, than it was last year. So I'm pumped about this.
Well, you brought up Olsen, and he is one of two other players that were free agents that the team brought back, one of which was Olsen himself. And the other is Clichon Page. Both of these signings, I think both of these players last year, if you watch them, Page played a lot at the end of the season. Olsen unfortunately suffered an injury in the same game that Caleros did. Caleros' injury obviously overshadowed it, but that to me was a big loss for the offensive line, because Olsen, who was brought in, I believe, after the season started in 2014, he had a relationship with Dan LeFevre. I believe they were college teammates. He came in and he struggled because American offensive linemen do tend to struggle. I was talking to Brian Simmons one time and asked him, like, what was the biggest, when did you kind of figure out when things started clicking? And he said, it took a season, took a whole year before I found, you know, 1 yard off the ball, all these different sorts of rules that play in Canada. So you saw Olsen get better as his first season progressed. And I thought he really, really played well last year, because again, with an offensive lineman, if you're not talking about him, they're doing their job. And he was a guy that no one was talking about. He was out there doing his job. So I'm glad he returns. And Clichon Page played in the secondary. The Ticats once again are looking for guys to play in the secondary. He came on at the end of the season last year and played due to some injuries. And I thought he played really well. Obviously, you know, he wasn't an all-star caliber player or anything like that, but this can be one of those signings where he's a guy that we don't really talk about much at this point in the season, but once we get to, you know, the midway point, we're going, oh, this guy, what a great guy to bring back. And he's kind of made some moves, like we talked about Emmanuel Davis in the past. He was in and out of the roster. He was, you know, practice roster at some points. He was game day cuts. He'd been cut by the team. Took him a while to kind of gel, and I think these are two players that the team brought back that aren't getting a ton of headlines, but could be guys that contribute to this team at some point in 2016. Olsen maybe a little less so, because again, he's coming back from a devastating injury. But again, I think these are some good moves that the team made.
Yeah, and you know, Olsen started 12 games last year at left tackle. I mean, he has the size. He's freaking huge. He's 6'8", 315 pounds. I mean, this guy's a mammoth. So, you know, he has the size. He has the strength to be a real contributor. You know, we just got to find out, like you said, about the injury, if he's fully recovered from that and he can, you know, make a good comeback and play the way he played last year before the injury. So we shall find out about that. And Paige, you know, he started some games last year. He did a pretty good job, and he's really, really young. He's only 23 years old. So this guy has a lot of time to mature, you know, time to get better. He has a lot of, he's just so young that, you know, there's so much potential there that he could, you know, be a backup for a couple of years and then come in and be a starter in the future and really contribute. So yeah, I'm happy about these two signings, and I think they'll be good Ticats for years to come.
Yeah, it's always good to bring back your own guys, I find, because it says that you're developing them properly. You like the guys you have. So when you see guys who, even though they tested the free agent waters, probably didn't, like Olsen especially because of the injury, probably didn't get a ton of interest. And Page was not a guy that was very well known. So these weren't exactly like key contributors that the team was going to lose. But you bring them back, you develop them more. And I think that's where you see the teams. Like, you look at Calgary, for example. They bring their guys, they do a heck of a great job of re-signing their own players, because they're the guys that develop. They're the guys that know the system, so they feel comfortable. Once a guy, that you don't see them overspend in free agency, you don't see them try to make a big splash. You see them bring in pieces here and there, but for the most part, they trust their scouting and their development. And I'm starting to see that with the Ticats. We've seen over the years them bring in guys, and even this offseason, they brought in a guy like Chad Owens, and they don't not bring in free agents, Ted LaRon a few years ago, so on and so forth. But now you're starting to see them develop their own players and keep them in house, and I think that bodes well for them being a team like Calgary that is double-digit wins and constantly in the Grey Cup conversation for years to come.
Yeah, we can only hope. I mean, it's just nice to have a contender year in and year out when you're a Ticats fan, and went through some lean years back in the day. So yeah, it's good to see bring back your own players and have that cohesion, because we didn't do that for a while. You know, for a couple of years we were just bringing in those big names, trying to make a big splash in free agency, and it just didn't work out. So this is a better strategy, in my opinion. Not like you said. Not that we don't bring in free agents, but, you know, it's not how we're improving the team year after year, you know, bringing in those big free agents. You know, bringing a couple here and there, that's fine, but it's tough to make a huge difference when all you're doing is bringing in guys from other teams.
Well, and building through free agency is something, like you said, we've seen the Ticats try to do and not do well. How many times did they sign, you know, trade for Jason Moss, sign Casey Printers, Chris Brazel, I remember. I don't know why he's the one. He came from BC, and I just remember my dad was really excited about Chris Brazel. Oh, this is the guy, BC receiver. This is going to be huge. And I don't even know if he lasted a season here. He didn't produce. Like, building through free agency is not the best idea. We've seen Winnipeg do it the last couple of years, and we're going to see if that pays off this year, but it didn't pay off for them last year. Saskatchewan went out and signed a bunch of guys. And like I said, we've seen the Ticats do this year after year after year, until recently, go out and try to nab the big fish. And sometimes it's panned out. Andy Fantuz, despite all his injuries, I think was a good signing by the team. Going out and getting Zach Caleros was a great signing by the team. But they don't go out and they're not trying to win the Grey Cup in February like they used to do. They would always be proclaimed as, oh, the Ticats won the offseason. And that led to very little actual wins during the regular season and no playoff appearances. So to see them develop their own players, to do the scouting, to trust who they bring in, that's the kind of tactic I want to see them go forward with. This bringing in expensive players, because in free agency you overspend on guys, and sometimes it works out. Look at Ottawa last year. It worked out well for them, but then this year they lost a bunch of guys, so there's always a give and take. Much better for me, in my opinion, for teams to kind of develop their own players, and that's what I'm seeing the Ticats doing now. And a way that they're developing their players is, we've touched on it a couple of times, mini camps opened today for Hamilton. They're a three-day mini camp. Unlike some other teams, they did not go down to Florida. A bunch of teams went down to Florida to do their camps and brought, like, everybody with them. The Ticats are doing things a little differently, and this is kind of how they've done it the last couple of years, is they will bring in sort of, like, first-year players. They'll bring some free agents that they're looking at. I wouldn't say it's a tryout camp necessarily, but it's a little bit more of that than it is, say, your standard mini camp where teams are installing offenses and going over stuff like that. And this is kind of how the Ticats have run it the last few years. They haven't really invited the veteran players. Really, outside of the quarterbacks, none of the veteran players from the team are there. You're not going to see Andy Fantuz or Luke Tasker or Simone Lawrence there. They trust their core group, knows what they're doing, knows how to keep themselves in condition, so they're not worried about bringing them in. But that doesn't mean that there's not a few interesting players the team has brought in. And if the one that has to top the list is Jeff Tisdale is going to participate in Hamilton's minicamp. A 9 or 10 year veteran in the CFL, and still he played a couple games last year, I believe, with Saskatchewan before he was released. He's been with Montreal, he's been with Calgary, he's been with Hamilton a couple times. To see his name on the list was kind of interesting. I guess he's still trying to keep the dream alive, so to speak.
Yeah, a veteran presence in the secondary. I think last year I wanted him to sign with the Ticats when I believe he was a free agent at one point. I can't remember, but like you said, trying to keep the dream alive. Maybe he still has something in the tank. Maybe he can crack the roster and be a veteran presence in the secondary and really help out this Ticats team. But or maybe he comes into minicamp and just, you know, doesn't impress and you don't see him again. So, you know, there's no harm in bringing these guys in, taking a look at them, and seeing what they still have left in the tank, because you never know if he can still play this game, you know, still play at a high level. You know, it's a possibility. So no harm bringing them in.
A couple other veterans that the team has brought in, offensive lineman Scott Mitchell, who I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, was like the second or third overall pick in the CFL draft about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, second overall to the Eskimos, I believe.
Okay, so, and then I think he left Edmonton and signed with Toronto last year or the year before. Didn't play a ton. Again, could be a guy that they use an offensive lineman at some more depth for the team. I believe he's a big, big, big lad. So they seem to be, they have a type. You mentioned Jake Olsen is a monster of a human being. They seem to have a type of who they like on the offensive line. Zach Anderson, a defensive lineman formerly of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, who was cut after they brought in all those veteran players and free agents this year. But if you look at his numbers, they're not spectacular. But in 35 games for Winnipeg over the last 3 years, 81 tackles and 10 sacks, not exactly terrible numbers for a guy who plays defensive tackle. So could this guy be maybe a Brian Hall replacement? Could he be coming in to see if they like him and then maybe he battles for a spot at camp? Not exactly someone that you would have thought they'd bring in, but could be one of those guys, like we mentioned before, of players who you don't talk about as much now, but become contributors later on. And another one is David Lee, who is a defensive end that had lastly played for the Rough Riders. And I remember him being very well liked amongst the people in Saskatchewan, but, you know, what, for one reason or another was let go. And now he's here trying to keep the dream alive, as we said earlier. So there's some veteran players here who are looking to crack the roster. And I think maybe that hunger might see some of these guys, if not all of them, make it to training camp and maybe compete for some spots.
Yeah, and really, you know, set a fire under some of these guys that are, you know, think they have a spot locked up with the Ticats and bring in some really good competition. I mean, these guys have played well on other CFL teams. You know, they're not superstars, but yeah, they've contributed over the years. And, you know, is Zach Anderson isn't a Canadian, is he?
No, I don't believe so.
Oh, yeah, he's American. So, yeah, I mean, he did a pretty good job in Winnipeg. And, you know, David Lee had his moments with Saskatchewan as well. So, you know, I just like the high level of competition that they're bringing in for training camp, if they make it to the actual training camp. So some notable guys that have come in that kind of took me by surprise because I didn't expect to see players that I knew of that had experience with other teams at minicamp. So it's a good thing to bring in that known commodities that will rise the level of competition.
There's also a couple other guys that they brought in. Jasper Collins was a wide receiver for the team last year. They re-signed him, and he's at camp. He played in a couple of games last year, as far as I remember. And if I'm not mistaken, his very first catch of his career was that long bomb touchdown pass from Caleros to himself in the game against Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
In Saskatchewan. So there's a guy who they're familiar with that maybe they're thinking could contribute some more in the future. Does the name Ellis Lankster mean anything to you?
Yes, I know that he had some, you know, some playing time in the NFL with the Jets, I believe. I know that you were pretty high on him last year, and it didn't really pan out, but I guess they brought him back. So we shall see if he cracks the roster this year.
Yeah, last year, like you mentioned, I had him pegged to start in the secondary in week one. And he was signed by the team, and he suffered an injury. It might have even been at minicamp, or it might have been at rookie camp. And they just, he's a guy who was on the bubble. You suffer an injury, we can't keep you, we got to get rid of you and bring someone else and take your spot. But again, there must be something about him that they liked, because he's been brought back. He's recovered, obviously, from his injury. So if this is a guy whose name I think we should be keeping near the top of our heads when it comes to potential unknowns who contribute to this team this year, not just because last year I said that he would be a starter in the secondary, but just if you bring a guy back after you've already had him, there's clearly something the team likes about him.
Yeah, they must be pretty high on him to, you know, give him another shot with the team. So, yeah, keep an eye on him. And the big question mark for the Ticats has been who's going to replace Justin Medlock. And we have, you know, some names that are at Ticats minicamp. We have Riders punter, former Riders punter Ray Early, ex-Red Blacks Brett Maher. Is that his name? Maher,
I think is how you pronounce it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Delbert Alvarado, and former Alabama kicker Cody Mandel. So those are some names that might be vying for, you know, a chance to replace the great Justin Medlock. So, you know, those are some names right there.
Yeah, I think the kicking competition is something that's going to stretch into actual training camp. I think they did this huge kicker invite a few weeks ago where they had like 13, 14 guys come in. I don't know if they've culled that list down to these four players or not, but it's clear that these are the guys that they like, or maybe these are just the guys that were available at the time. You never know. The one thing that sticks out about them is they're all Americans. So clearly the Ticats aren't using Medlock's departure as a way to shift the ratio in any way. They're looking at American kickers, unless, of course, they take that UBC kid whose name I'm not even going to try to pronounce because I'm probably going to mess it up. Unless they take him in the draft and use him, because that's always a possibility. But these look like the guys one of which you're probably going to see kicking for the Ticats next season. I don't mean to be a pessimist, but none of these names really... The kid from Alabama, I don't really know all that much. But these other three don't exactly inspire a lot of confidence.
No, they're definitely not on the level that Medlock was at. And, you know, we're not going to find, I don't think, a kicker as good as Medlock. So, you know, we'll just have to see. They don't really, you know, make me too excited either. Maybe this kid from Alabama is a hidden gem and he can really kick the ball well, but the other names that I'm familiar with don't really excite me that much.
Yeah, I can't really add much more to that. I feel the exact same way. Obviously, it's just you know maybe a change of scenery. Maybe you see players who don't perform somewhere go elsewhere and perform really well. With kickers, though, I don't know. Alvarado and Maher both kicked in Ottawa, and Hamilton's kicking conditions are a lot worse. That the wind there can be kind of cumbersome, to say the least. I don't know. I don't really have a lot of confidence in these guys to... Look, they're not going to be Justin Medlock. There's no one else who kicks in this league, and in most leagues, who is Justin Medlock, if we're being perfectly honest. That's a big loss in the kicking game. Mr. Automatic, he went out there. You always knew he was going to nail the field goal no matter how far he was kicking. That's not the case anymore. We just kind of got to live with it. But whoever does come in and gets the kicking job, obviously, we hope to do a good job, but I got to see it before I'll believe.
Yeah, same here. You know, it's going to be tough whoever comes in because you're always going to be comparing it to Medlock. But, yeah, I guess you just can't do that because it's a fresh start and, you know, hopefully the team just scores touchdowns. No field goals.
Scores touchdowns, goes for 2 points, and all they have to do is worry about kickoffs and then the defense will do the rest.
Exactly.
Okay. That's all for the Ticat news for this week. There was quite a bit of it, but I think we did a good job of recapping everything for everyone. Let's get on to some CFL stuff. That sound good to you?
Yep, let's do it.
So the league has announced their new rules for the year, and they were met with, I wouldn't say universal, I'm blanking on the word I want to use, and I feel like a jackass. Anyway, they weren't exactly, pardon? Praise?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's a good word to use. They weren't exactly just embraced by everybody. So it's mostly because it had the big ones. There's a list of, I think there was 10 new rules that were adopted. We're not going to cover all of them because some of them are just a little bit boring, to be perfectly honest. It's minutia that I don't think anyone really cares about. But we're going to talk about the big ones, and they have to do with video review. The huge one is that there's going to be an official in the video review booth who is going to correct unchallengeable errors. The example being used here is whether a penalty call was illegal procedure or it was offside. So you see two guys move, the refs make a decision, this guy in the booth immediately can watch the play and go, nope, the defensive guy moved, so it's on them, or nope, the offensive guy moved, it's on them, and correct it, you know, in real time. Mm-hmm. This is a highly controversial decision that I like the idea of getting these errors right. I'm not entirely sold on if this will work. Will it slow down the game? You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's very, I wish this was one of those things where they were saying, we're going to try it in the preseason first, and then if we find that it works, we'll adopt it in the regular season. There's just too many unknown variables with this right now for me to be 100% behind it. How about you?
Yeah, I don't think that anyone would really have a problem with it if they didn't think it would slow down the game. I think that's what all the fans are concerned about, is, you know, slowing down the game more. You know, we've seen over the years, well, the last 2 years or so with all the flags, it's really cut up the pace of the game. It's slowed down the game. I think that's all the fans are worried about, is just slowing down the game. And I don't know if this is going to do that or not. You know, if it's bang, 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 and they make a decision quickly and they move on to the next play, then I'm all for it. You know, I want to get the calls right as much as possible. But if it's going to slow down the game more, then I'm not for it. So it was just going to have to be a wait and see thing. You know, I'd like to see it tested in the preseason before it's, you know, done in the regular season, because, you know, it's going to be a process to get this thing really flowing well. So like I said before, I'm all for it as long as it doesn't really slow down the game.
Yeah, the first time that you see both an offensive lineman move and a defensive lineman jump, and it takes 30 seconds before they make the penalty call, you're going to hear a lot of boos and a lot of chatter from fans about how this is not going to work. So maybe the idea should have been, let's try it in the preseason. If it works as smoothly as we hope and there's not too much backlash from it, from the reasonable fans, there's always going to be someone out there who says, like, video review in general is a terrible idea. And as much as, yeah, it can slow down the game in aspects, I kind of weigh that against getting the calls right. And I understand the argument human error is a part of the game and we don't expect players to be perfect, but why do we expect officials to be perfect? They're officiating the game, and if you look at anywhere where you work, if you make a mistake, it's not as big a deal as if the manager of the building makes a mistake. You know what I mean? Like, you can make an error and it doesn't necessarily affect the overall flow of the work area. But if the guy who runs the entire business screws up, that can really put a monkey wrench in things. And I kind of look at it this way, where referees are sort of the, if they make a massive mistake that can't be corrected, that can have repercussions going through the rest of the season, and teams could miss the playoffs or teams could lose a championship. And you never want that to be on the heads of the refs. You never want there to be any excuses. Really, when your team, especially if it's your favorite team, when they lose, you don't want to be able to go, "Oh, the refs, you know, screwed us over." And people are going to say that regardless, you know, video review or no video review. I just see this as, again, something that they want to be at the forefront of changes in sports. The CFL is always really good about doing things first and being the leader in innovation. I just worry that this may be an innovation that maybe should have been looked at a little bit more before it was fully implemented.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you just want to get everything right, but it makes the product less watchable. Then that's a big problem for the league, because, you know, ratings dropped last year, and they got to get that back up. So, you know, I know they're trying to improve the game, get less penalties, make it, the flow better, but, you know, they're gonna go through some growing pains with this change, I think. So, you know, and they've had some other changes too. They added more to the list of challengeable plays, which isn't necessarily going to slow down the game, because the coaches still have the same amount of challenges, I believe. But what do you think about, you know, offensive pass interference being challengeable, no yards, and many more? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I always thought if you're going to have pass interference be challengeable, it should have gone both ways to begin with. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, just why is it taken now into – this will be the third season with defensive pass interference being challengeable. Why did it take that long to get offensive pass interference as a challengeable penalty? I don't really know. I'm fine with expanding what is and isn't challengeable, simply because, like you said, it's not going to extend it any longer, because coaches aren't getting more challenges. They're just getting more things they can challenge. And it's still going to take, if both coaches want to use both their challenges in a game, it's going to take the same, no matter if that challenge is a no yards penalty or a pass interference penalty or whatever, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's still there's a finite amount of challenges that a team can use. So it doesn't really matter if they just expand what can be challenged. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah, is there three challenges now? They can challenge three times. If they get one right, they get...
I think if you get your two right, you can challenge a third time.
Okay.
I think you have to get both of them right to be able to get that third challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, I also don't have a problem with them expanding the list of challengeable plays, because, you know, it's not like they have infinite challenges, so it's not going to slow down the game at all, I don't think. You know, if they want to challenge a no-yards call, I don't think that's going to happen very often, because, you know, unless it's a caught ball where it's a 15-yard penalty, I don't think coaches are going to be challenging no yards when it will be just a 5-yard penalty. So, yeah, extend it all you want, as long as they don't give more challenge flags to the coaches, you're not going to slow down the game. So I think it's a good thing to, you know, extend that list.
I like no yards being challengeable personally, because I think the one you're going to see that challenge most of is when a punt returner fumbles the ball. And if that guy was in that 5-yard halo, my only concern is it's tough to decide where that 5-yard halo is, but there's got to be a technology there where you can even quickly, you know, zap where, for instance, we'll use him as an example, because he's our guy, Brandon Banks, and then just do a quick 5-yard halo circle around him. If the guy's in there and it's a penalty. But I'm very happy that that's a challengeable play, and I don't know for the longest time why it wasn't. Now that it is, it's kind of like that's one of those ones where it seems like it should have been reviewable forever ago.
Yeah, like a lot of these plays that are reviewable now, it just makes sense, in my opinion, if you're not slowing down the game by adding more challenges to the coaches for the coaches to have, then why not have every play, you know, reviewable? It just makes sense.
Yeah, and these are the rules now going forward, so we either get used to them or we bitch and complain about them and stop watching the game. And I, for one, am not going to stop watching the game because roughing the passer is now a reviewable play.
Yeah, that's a good thing too. I mean, we've seen over the last couple of years where, you know, questionable roughing the passer calls have been made. You know, a guy barely gets touched and the flag gets thrown. You know, it's I understand they're trying to protect the quarterbacks, and that's a great thing. You know, we've seen last year, like, all the quarterbacks that went down, we need to protect these guys. We need to protect the stars of the game. But, you know, if a guy gets breathed on, you know, sometimes the flag gets thrown. So, yeah, I think, you know, roughing the quarterback is a valuable play to be able to challenge.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these things that they're now challengeable, like illegal interference or illegal interference on kickoffs. Like, I think these are things that they've added that you're not necessarily going to see all that often. Like, there's a couple that I think you'll see more of, obviously. But I think this is kind of, you know, it's the off season. There's not a ton to talk about amongst the CFL fandom, and I think it's just one of those things where, oh, this happened and it's new, so we're going to complain about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're gonna see how it plays out this season. And you know, the league is trying to cut down on all these penalties. They really are. You know, I saw something that they want to cut down on hundreds of penalties, not just a couple, like hundreds. So we're going to see if this is going to work out. Like, if they can get rid of a lot of these penalties, this game will be so fun to watch. Like, I remember back, you know, when the league was struggling off the field back in the 90s, you know, the entertainment value of the league on the field was through the roof. So if we can get the way it is now off the field, we're in a pretty good spot for the most part. If we can get this great, exciting product back on the field, we're laughing. You know, it'll just be so much fun to be a CFL fan.
Yeah, the sky's the limit. And in talking about this, so to give a little inside baseball, Mike and I, before the show, will discuss the things that we're going to talk about. And this one I completely forgot about, but we have to touch on it. It's the officiating agreement between the NFL and the CFL. Mm-hmm. I can't believe neither of us brought this up in our pre-show meeting. I can't believe we forgot about it, but we have to talk about this. This is a really big development. We're going to have NFL officials working CFL games, and we're going to have CFL officials going down and working NFL training camps and being in the NFL coaching. Like, it to me, that I think this more than anything could be that big leap forward that we see in officiating for the Canadian Football League.
Yeah, the more, you know, the more training you can get, the better. You know, they go down to the NFL, they, you know, see how that works, they get more work. You know, I think it's going to be a good thing. You know, the NFL refs coming here is going to be interesting. You know, they're not just preseason games, but regular season games up until the NFL season starts. I was very surprised by this. I did not see this coming. And, you know, I don't think the NFL refs will be, you know, the main referees. They won't be, you know, calling the flags because the league's rules are so much different. But, yeah, there's going to be NFL refs up here and, you know, CFL refs down there. So I'm interested to see how this all plays out and if it makes a big improvement on the reffing in the CFL.
My understanding is that the referees will be – they'll be more of like the boundary – like they won't be – it's not – the head referee is not going to be an NFL referee.
No.
It's going to – they're going to be in positions where they can still – you know, they can still call penalties and they can still do all that other stuff, but they're not going to be the ultimate decision makers. On the field, which to me is good because it allows for these NFL officials to get more game reps themselves and to maybe learn this game because maybe they want to ref up here at some point. And it also allows the CFL officials to get more training, like you said. And that to me is the most important thing out of this, is that we're going to see CFL officials getting more work, getting more training, getting better training, which to me, whether that's in the NFL or the CFL, I don't care where it is, guys learning more about the game, guys getting better at the game, I think that will work.
Yeah, it can only be a benefit to the league. Like, it can't hurt. So, yeah, I'm all for it. It's a good thing.
For sure, for sure. Okay, so enough about officiating. Let's move on to some actual player stuff. And there were a few retirements since the last time you and I got together. Some of them, honestly, of the surprising nature. We had Ben Heenan, the former first overall pick of the Saskatchewan Roughriders, decide to hang up his cleats. That one surprised me. We had Tyron Brackenridge decide to retire after a very, very good career, especially with the Rough Riders. He was an excellent player for them. But that one I kind of understand. He probably saw the options out there, didn't like what he saw, and decided it was better to hang him up than to try to make a team or whatever. And his legacy is secured. I thought he had an excellent career. I think he's one of those guys that didn't get as much publicity as I think he should have, because I think he was one of the better linebacker safety hybrids that we saw in the last few years. And Mo Price, our good buddy Mo Price, has decided to hang it up. I don't really know what to say about him. All I know is we spend a lot of time talking about Mo Price. the last couple of years, especially in regards to his movement from team to team. And I think now that he is no longer playing the game, we can officially say that he was involved in maybe the two most inconsequential trades in CFL history. His trade from Calgary to Ottawa for Jasper Simmons was something that we pored over, both in written form and on this show between you and I, quite a bit, and ended up meaning kind of nothing. And then this trade from Ottawa, Saskatchewan, he's never going to play for the Saskatchewan Roughriders, so that literally meant nothing. It's kind of crazy that we see these three guys retire. The Heenan one, though, took me completely by surprise.
Yeah, the Heenan one is the most shocking. I mean, this guy's 26 years old. He just came back from the NFL, short stint in the NFL. He could play in the CFL for another 10, 12 years. You know, offensive linemen tend to play longer than a lot of different positions. So, I mean, he could be making north of, I don't know, it could be north of 250, you think?
Yeah, like, for sure. Ted Laurent yeah. makes probably around that, and he's defensive lineman, obviously, but if you're a top-tier Canadian, I see no reason why he couldn't been close making $250,000. Yeah, close to three. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
So this guy can make some big money in the CFL, and he's so young that I guess he just, his heart's not in it. He doesn't want to play football anymore. He wants to go back to the farm and live that life. And that's, you know, that's great for him if he wants to do that. But there's just a lot of potential that's not going to be playing for, you know, for the Riders or for anyone else. So he says he can make more money farming. I guess there's a lot of money on his family farm, because I didn't know that, you know, farmers made north of 250 or around $300,000 a year. So I don't know. It's pretty surprising. You know, Mo Price is also surprising. When he first came into the league with the Stampeders, I thought that, you know, he could be a breakout star. He really lit the league on fire his first year and then kind of fell off. You know, last year with Ottawa, he was the only player that didn't have 1,000 yards receiving. He was kind of an afterthought with that Red Blacks offense. He dropped a lot of balls. He was not impressive last year at all. And, you know, he's gone. He was only 30 years old. You think he'd have a lot of playing time left, but, you know, I don't think it's a big loss for the league. I think that he squandered a lot of his talent and he just never lived up to his potential. And then Brackenridge, you know, I understand that. He's 31. You know, the defensive backs don't really play as long as some other positions. So he saw the light at the end of the tunnel and he just decided to call it a career. And like you said, I thought he had a really great career. I believe he was the one that would always come on those blitzes and just, you know, he could perfectly timed up his blitzes on so many plays and really got to the quarterback when he was with the Rough Riders. So he had a great career and I wish them all the best of luck. And you know, if I had to guess, I would say that Heenan is the most likely to make a comeback maybe after a year or two, and he just realizes how much he misses football. So that would be my guess for a guy to come back at all three of them.
Yeah, I you read my mind. That's I was going to ask you if you thought any of these guys would come back. I think Brackenridge is done. I think outside of maybe an injury to a team, like someone at his position gets hurt and they reach out and give him a call, maybe then we could see him back. But I think he's had a good career, like we both said. And I think Saskatchewan is where his heart was. I think him getting cut by there, I don't really think he really looked anywhere else. And I think even if he did look somewhere else, probably the money wasn't right to uproot his family and all that sorts of stuff. You see that kind of in the CFL, these veteran players. Like, we haven't seen Juwan Simpson get signed. And a couple years ago, he was one of the best linebackers in the league. So I can see where these guys are. They're not going to let themselves be lowballed. They're not going to go out and play football for $90,000. You know what I mean? So yep. I see him as one of those guys. Maybe the offers were there that just weren't to his liking. And I understand why he would say, you know, it's time to move on to the next phase of my life. We saw it with Avon Coburn. He got cut by the Ticats, and then the Ticats suffered an injury, and they brought him back. And again, these guys aren't going to play for peanuts. They're gonna play for what they believe they deserve to be paid, and I have absolutely no problem with that. Mo Price, to me, is just so interesting because I feel like he always had all the talent in the world to succeed and just never amounted to much. And I don't mean to be harsh, but it's like he squandered what could have been, I think, a very good career. He could have been what Eric Rogers is. If he would, I don't know if it was dedication. I don't know if his head, I don't want to guess on why he never really developed into that top tier player. But I think out of all of these three, I think he's the one I could see maybe in a year's time going, well, I think I kind of made a mistake here, and maybe tries to get back into the league.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see Mo Price trying to get back in. You know, maybe he's making a big mistake and, you know, taking the money and running, you know. I don't put anything against him for doing that. You know, we see it all the time. Teams cutting players right before they're due a bonus, And this is kind of the opposite side of it. Mo Price gets his bonus and then retires. So I don't squander him or, you know, judge him for that. Because it goes both ways, but you know, it just seems like he was, you know, such a cocky character, thought his talents were so great that he'd still be playing if he had the opportunity, and seemed like he really loved the game as well. So yeah, maybe he realizes that he made a mistake and gets back, tries to get back with another team in the CFL.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the bonus thing, because there's been a lot of fans out there, and I would say 99.9% have been Rider fans, who have ripped into Price for accepting that contract bonus and then retiring and them saying he should have to give it back and all this other sorts of stuff. And like you said, teams can cut players, do bonuses to not pay them. We saw it this offseason with two guys from Saskatchewan, Weston Dressler and John Chick, were both released when they were due bonuses. And
the day before.
Yeah, exactly. And no one really batted an eye. That's just the business of the game. But when a player does it, he kind of, and this seems to be sort of a theme when it comes to players and owners. And I don't know how this has happened where fans, I know, like, I'm a fan of the team and I'm a fan of the league. So players come and go and we accept that. But as a human being, I don't know how we have accepted the idea that these teams can be so cutthroat and he's not producing for us, or we got to pay him too much money, we're going to let him go. And we accept that and say, well, that's just the way the business works. Whereas we then, in the inverse, turn on these players who, quote unquote, take the money and run. I don't understand. Like, I just don't get the idea or understand the reasoning and the rationale behind how we have been indoctrinated to have this feeling. Because when you really think about it, shouldn't we really be on the players? These guys, they play for our entertainment, and that's what this is. This is entertainment. It is sport, but this is entertainment. We pay money to watch these guys play. Shouldn't we want them to, no matter what, get as much money as possible? Just on a human, like, these are people we cheer for. These are people we cheer against. These are people that go out and put their bodies on the line so that we have something to watch. We have something to go to. We have something to look forward to. I don't know about you, but during the season, like, my week is, oh man, the game is going to be on Friday. I can't wait. But then when these guys decide, I don't want to play anymore, and they take this money, we turn on them. And I just don't understand that rationale, that way of thinking.
No, it's a complete double standard. It's ridiculous. I mean, like you said, they play for the team. They put their bodies on the line. They sign the contract expecting to get these bonuses, which will really help them out, you know. We know that CFL players aren't making millions of dollars like the NFL or other leagues. So, you know, these bonuses are big things to these players, I assume. So when they get released the day before a big chunk of money is supposed to come their way, it's got to piss them off. It's a cold thing to do to a player. Like, you look at John Chick and Dressler. I mean, these guys have been stars for the team for years and sold merchandise up the ass. They've made a lot of money for the organization, and for a team to just cut them the day before they're due a big bonus it's really cold. It's not very nice. So I don't understand the double standard of, you know, the fans not caring when the player gets released the day before a big bonus is due, but then turning on the player when they do the exact same thing. It just doesn't make sense.
It's like when teams cut players when they no longer feel that they are performing at the contract level they played, and fans are like, that's the business. But when a player signs a contract and then outperforms the deal he signed, Chris Williams is the perfect example of this.
Yeah.
Chris Williams was with the Hamilton Tiger Cats for two seasons and absolutely 100% outplayed the contract that he signed. And when he said, I don't think I'm being paid enough, and of course there was also the NFL interest, but we've seen this with a lot of players, I don't think I'm being paid enough, when he wanted to redo his deal because he had outperformed his money, fans turned on him en masse saying, he signed a contract, you should live up to that, you're not a man of your word. But when a team, if Chris Williams had not performed up to his contract and the team decided, you're not living up to your end of the bargain, we are going to get rid of you, no one would have said a thing. No. And like, maybe I'm just wired differently, but I just don't, you mentioned that it's cold, and it is, it's very cold, it's very not nice, but we accept it as part of the business. Shouldn't we then also accept that players who go, I'm not being paid enough, I want to be paid more, and are doing what's best for them, also part of the business? We're okay with teams doing what's best for them, but we're not okay with players doing what's best for them. It seems, like you said, a kind of crazy double standard.
Yeah, it's kind of a selfish thing. Fans of the team, you know, they're just looking at they want the best players on the team. And like the Chris Williams example, if like I really wanted Chris Williams to come back and play for the Ticats, but I understand what he did. You know, I know that the Ticats said that they'd make him like one of the highest paid players in the league, but you know, if he has that opportunity to go down south, then I think that they should give him that you know, opportunity to take a shot down there. But yeah, it's just like a selfish thing. People want the best players on their team, and if they signed a contract, they want them to stick with it. So yeah, it's a complete double standard. And like I said before, these guys don't make a lot of money compared to other leagues, so they got to take advantage of what they can in a short period of time because the careers are so short. So they got to make as much money as possible, and I don't begrudge them. I don't begrudge Price for taking the money and, you know, retiring. I just think that it happens all the way, you know, all the time, the other way around. So I don't have any problem with the player doing this.
It's interesting that we're both on the same side of this, because I think if we were to do a poll, I think you and I would be on one side and most everyone else would be on the other. And yeah, I just I don't understand it. But let's move on to the CFL drug policy. There finally is one. And if I can be frank, I think it's pretty punitive. Punitive. Wow, I can't talk today. So there's basically a four strikes and you're out policy. So for your first positive test, it's a 2-game ban. Your second is a 9-game ban. Your third is a 1-year ban. And then your fourth is you're done. You cannot come back. I think after last year, there was a lot of talk about how the league didn't have a drug policy and how that made it look Bush League and all that sorts of stuff. Now they have one that I think has some real teeth. When have we ever seen a player suspended for more than one game? Even Khalif Mitchell, I think, when he tried to rip Simeon Rotier's arm out of its socket, I think he only got one game. Maybe he got two and I'm remembering it wrong. But 2-game suspension for your first positive test, I think that's that's pretty harsh. Not unduly harsh. Like, I think you're taking drugs to enhance your performance. You should be suspended. But yeah, for a first time offense, 2 games is a pretty big chunk.
Yeah, compared to what it was, you know, I think the first offense in the old policy was mandatory rehab and your name wouldn't be released. So compared to that, yeah, it's a big big step forward. I think that this, I don't think it's too harsh. I think that I think they did what they had to do. You know, I forget what they're called, the Canadian Drug Ethic Company or whatever that was doing the testing before kind of said, we're not going to do your testing last year because they didn't respect the league's policies. So I think that this is a good thing. You know, you got to try to get rid of the performance-enhancing drugs in the league. You know, it's cheating. It's wrong. So it's a lot better than what it was. And I'm pretty happy about it because it's just good for the league to, you know, you can't not have a drug policy like we did last year. It's just not a good thing. So I think this is a good step forward for the league and brings a little bit more respectability to it.
Well, and I think the big thing for me personally that this policy has is I'm not usually a big fan of lifetime bans, but you get 4 opportunities to clean yourself up and you can't, you're out. I think that's fair. But the big thing to me is that marijuana is not one of the items that'll be tested for. We see a lot of suspensions in the NFL for guys who like to smoke marijuana. And I am not a marijuana smoker. Not to say I've never done it, but not for a very long time. It's not my thing. But I don't look down on anyone who does. I'm not one of those people who look at marijuana and go, that's the devil's drug or that's a gateway drug. It's not. I really don't think that. And I think with our advancing attitudes on marijuana, where we're probably a year away from it being illegal substance in Canada, the fact that that is not a banned substance means that this drug policy is more focused on performance enhancing drugs. You're not going to get a guy getting a 2-game suspension because he had a couple tokes after a game or during the offseason to unwind. And to me, I think that's a huge step forward, not just for a drug policy perspective, but from a societal perspective, where this was announced as not being a banned substance and no one really flipped out about it. If this was 20, 25, 30 years ago, people would have been, well, weed's not good for you. Now people are just kind of like, it's kind of accepted. And to me, I think that looks good on us as a society, as well as making this drug policy about what it needs to be about, which is performance-enhancing substances.
I totally agree. You know, smoking a joint isn't going to help your performance, obviously. To me, it's, you know, not as bad as alcohol. I think that, you know, you're not testing for alcohol. You shouldn't be testing for weed. It's just, like you, I've smoked it in the past, and I don't think it's that harmful. I don't think that players should be suspended for it. I think in the NFL, you know, a guy like Josh Gordon gets suspended for a year and, you know, Ray Rice beats the crap out of his wife and gets, you know, four games or whatever it was at first. So
it was two.
You know, two games. And, you know, Josh Gordon has a couple tokes and he gets suspended a year. It's just ridiculous. It's beyond stupid. And, you know, people are like, well, that's the rule. Well, it's a stupid rule. You should change the rule. So I'm in total agreement. I don't think it should be a banned substance. You know, it's weird that it's legal in two states in America, and they have such strict policies on it in the NFL. So, yeah, I'm in total agreement. I don't think it should be a banned substance in the CFL, and I'm glad it's not.
Yeah, like I said, this means that the focus is on drugs that will help you play better. And that, to me, is what these drug policies should be about. They shouldn't be about policing people's personal habits. It shouldn't be like that at all. And you bring up Josh Gordon, and that's a great example. Like, he's now missed probably close to, considering all the suspensions he's had, two or more years of his career. But he's not doing drugs that are going to help him play any better. And it just seems like to not have that worry in the CFL, we're not going to see a guy get suspended two games for unwinding. And like you said, to me, it's no different than having a beer after work. Some people like to have alcohol. Some people don't. And this drug is going to soon be a legal substance in Canada. It would make absolutely no sense when it has completely no performance-enhancing possibilities that this would be something that the league should ban. And I, for one, applaud the league. We take some shots at the league from now again, and we say things. Some of the things they do aren't right. I applaud the league on leaving this out. I think that they've done a great job, and they deserve all the kudos that they get for it, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Now, we were talking about Josh Gordon a bit. Now, there's been rumors that he, you know, might end up in the CFL because I believe he just got suspended again for pot. So, you know, I know that there's a rule between leagues. If the one player is suspended, then he can't come to the CFL. But if he's released from his contract, then I believe he can. So would you have a problem with him coming and signing with the CFL team? I believe the Stampeders have his rights.
Well, my understanding is this new drug policy will also enforce drug suspensions from other leagues. The Josh Gordon one, however, is interesting because under the CFL policy, he wouldn't have been suspended. So it would be interesting to see if he is released by the Browns and then comes up north. No, I would have no problems with Josh Gordon coming up here. He has never proven to me, like I said before, he's been suspended a bunch because he doesn't have a drug problem, because it's not like, I don't know, I did this. Maybe it's the American influence in the NFL's way of thinking, but smoking marijuana to me is not the end of the world. I know a lot of people who are very highly motivated, highly successful, who their you know, drug of choice, their relaxer of choice is marijuana. Mm. No, I would have absolutely no problems with Josh Gordon playing up here, and I think if anyone who does, I think they're living in the past.
You know, this is a guy who led the league, led the NFL in receiving a couple of years ago. This is a huge talent. I believe he's still only 24 or somewhere around that. You know, if you can bring in a guy like that, then, you know, that's, you know, go for it. I mean, this guy hasn't had any problems except for, you know, the pot smoking. He hasn't hurt anyone else. He hasn't been arrested for anything else that I know of. So, you know, I have no problem with, if the Stampeders had the opportunity to bring him in, why not? This, you know, there's no signs that this guy is a bad person. He just, you know, smoked a little pot. So I don't see the big problem with bringing him in if you have the opportunity.
Hell, even if he smokes a lot of pot, if he is just like if he's Snoop Dogg when it comes to pot, and it's just he's got a joint hanging out of his mouth 24/7 when he's not on the football field, if he can smoke that much dope and still be the leading receiver in the National Football League, good, you know, more power to him. Like, here's the thing. So We sit here and people will bash Josh Gordon for being suspended so much for smoking weed. But if I don't know if you know this, but in Super Bowl I, Max McGee went out the night before the Super Bowl and got absolutely plastered, played in the Super Bowl hungover, and caught the first two touchdown passes of the game for the Green Bay Packers, went on to win the Super Bowl. That is a story that we tell people as, oh man, this guy, he went out and partied and he got all lit and look what he was able to do. Joe Namath, party animal. But we laud him as this legend because of, you know, the guarantee and all that stuff. David Wells. Remember David Wells, the baseball pitcher?
Yep.
Played for the Blue Jays. He threw a perfect game for the Yankees and came out and said, I was hungover when I threw that. And like, we look at these people and we tell these stories with reverence. Like, look at what people can do. Babe Ruth was a drunk and would play drunk. And no one seems to care. But when it comes to marijuana, it seems like this is the one substance that if you do, you're kind of an outcast. And for as little harm as it actually does on someone, and like I said, and I've said this numerous times, it will soon be legal in this country. Guaranteed. The government has already announced that they plan in the next year to make this drug legal for purchase. Why the heck are we looking at Josh Gordon going, this is someone who is a social pariah because he likes to get high? Like, I don't – like, what's the difference between getting high and getting drunk? I don't really see the difference.
Well, the difference is you get super drunk and you may black out and do something you regret. You know, you can smoke a million joints and you're not going to forget anything. You're not going to do anything stupid. So
do something stupid. Like, you might eat, an entire bag of Doritos. But other than that, like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, tongue-in-cheek, obviously.
You're not going to black out. You're not going to, you know. So, yeah, you're right. There's a double standard. I think it's because as a society, we've been beaten over the head about how bad marijuana is for years and years and years when it actually isn't that bad. So it's just like people believe what they're told by authority figures, I guess, and that's why there's such a bad stigma around it.
Yeah, I just – like you look at Josh Gordon, who's not done much. And then I know you mentioned it off air, but you want to talk about Johnny Manziel. There's someone who – he clearly has a substance abuse problem.
Yeah.
Like, he is someone who is – like, Josh Gordon, people could argue, and I'm sure someone will argue with us about Josh Gordon having a substance abuse problem because he's ruined his career. But the one thing is funny is Josh Gordon has never been released by the Cleveland Browns.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Manziel's problems have caused him to be released. And the only reason I bring him up is – A, because you want to talk a bit about him in the pre-show, because he is on a neg list, and he is on our neg list. He's technically, quote-unquote, property of the Hamilton Tiger Cats. With him not being signed to the NFL, he's not facing any suspensions. There is the possibility that he could come up here, and I think the stuff that he has done is 10 times worse than the stuff that Josh Gordon has done. Like, I believe everyone deserves a second chance, and everyone deserves an opportunity to better their lives. But I would hope, at least, and this is my feeling, that his signing in the CFL would bring a lot more derision than Josh Gordon's would.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Like, with Josh Gordon, I would open, you know, I would welcome with open arms. Johnny Manziel, I think that, you know, I think his problems are with alcohol more so than anything else, maybe hard drugs. I've heard some rumors and stuff like that, but I don't know for sure or anything like that. But then he has these charges that he beat up his ex-girlfriend and, you know, stuff like that that I think the league should shy away from. I don't think it would be if we just look at the player on the field, you know, his play in college, I think that his talents would really – his play would be – he's like a Doug Flutie type of player. You know, you could see a lot of good things that could come from him playing in the CFL. Maybe the CFL is a better game for him than the NFL with his scrambling abilities and the way that he made plays on the go in college. But the off-field stuff, I think, is a little bit too much. I think it would look bad on the league if they brought him in just because he has so many off-the-field problems. He has substance abuse problems. He seems to be getting in trouble with the law with you know, abusive behavior towards others. So the Josh Gordon thing, thumbs up. Bring him in if you can. Johnny Manziel, I'm not so sure. Maybe if he cleaned up his life a bit, then you could bring him in and he could be a great talent in the CFL. But as of this point, I'd shy away from Johnny Football.
Well, we know that he has an alcohol problem, and that alcohol problem then stemmed into him allegedly committing a physical assault on a female. We know that if you want to label it as Josh Gordon has a marijuana problem, that hasn't caused him to go kick the crap out of anyone, let alone kick the crap out of a woman. Like, we're okay with someone, you know, getting blackout drunk, like you said, but we're not okay with someone relaxing, having a couple joints. And it goes back to just this weird stigma that comes with smoking marijuana that I just can't wrap my head around. And yet, if you look at someone like, people have made fun of Josh Gordon, and now people are like super concerned for Johnny Manziel. But societally, we look at someone who, if he was just a drunk, I don't think, like I mentioned Joe Namath earlier, Joe Namath was Johnny Manziel in the 1960s and 1970s without, you know, the violence and all that other sorts of stuff. But he was a party boy. He was out there. He was the quarterback of the New York Jets, living the life of the quarterback of the New York Jets. Like, you're in the media capital of the world. You're the star of the team. You're strutting around wearing fur coats. He's out drinking. He's out partying. Same with Mickey Mantle. Mickey Mantle was out partying. He was the star of the New York Yankees. He was the king of the town. But we look at John, and so we kind of are okay with people going out and pounding back the liquor, but we're not okay. Like, I just keep going back to this, and I feel like I just keep repeating myself, but I just don't I can't understand it, because show me someone who likes to smoke a lot of dope, and I'll show you someone who just likes to relax and chill. Show me someone who gets blackout drunk all the time, and I'll show you someone who's probably not right in his mind. And I'm not sitting here trying to stigmatize alcohol. We all enjoy a few drinks. I know you enjoy your fair share of drinks, but I don't understand why both alcohol and marijuana aren't like kind of considered the same to a certain extent. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying. Like I said earlier, I think that alcohol is worse. So, you know, I'm totally on board with what you're saying. I totally agree with every word you just said. So it's just a double standard that doesn't make sense. It just doesn't. You know, one's legal, one's illegal, and maybe that's the problem.
That's got to be it, right? Like, that's got to be the – because that's the only difference I can find between the two, is that it's the legality of one. So when Canada decides – very soon that this was no longer legal, will the attitude shift? I guess we'll find out. I do see a lot of attitudinal shift, and I think it has a lot to do with our generation of people now being the people sort of engaging in power. We're becoming the people who make the decisions, and our attitudes are, it's not that big a deal. I think we will see it over the next couple of decades, that we're going to get to the point where people are going to look back and go, like, you know how we look back on the Prohibition era, like, why did you, like, ban alcohol? Like, that's just, who cares? Yeah. I think this is going to be the same thing. Our future generations are going to look back and go, marijuana was illegal? That's such a stupid thing to fight against.
Mm-hmm. And why did it take so long for it to be legalized, you know? It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. Okay, so enough of – that was a long, very long talk about the drug policy. Let's get back into some football stuff. And the CFL released their final scouting bureau rankings for the draft, which will be held in a couple of weeks. You and I have discussed numerous times how we're not exactly the most knowledgeable about the draft. We are hoping, this is, I guess, a bit of a tease, to get someone on here who is very knowledgeable about the draft. Nothing is set in stone yet, but, you know, fingers crossed that we can get our second guest on here who will school us all in the ways of the draft, because he is, for my money, the number one draft guy out there. You can probably guess who I'm talking about just by what I've said. But that doesn't mean we can't have a little fun with this and kind of touch on some stuff, because I have been paying a little bit more attention to the prospects this year than I have in previous years. I have a little bit of extra time, and it does allow – I watched a little bit of this of the Combine, which got me to know some of these players. So they released their final rankings, and Manitoba defensive lineman David Onyemata, I believe is how you pronounce his name, is number one on this list. Now, these lists are kind of this is not the order in which these guys will go, because Onyemata has NFL interest, and it's likely that he will never play a game in the CFL. So he's not going to be the number one overall pick. But there's some other guys, interesting candidates on here. A lot of defensive linemen, a lot of offensive linemen. I don't know if you read the story about Alex Singleton, the Montana State prospect who has played in the NFL a little bit. He just got his Canadian citizenship. So now, like, his mother was born in Canada. So even though he was born in California, that allows him to be a Canadian. He was on the Red Blacks negotiation list. They tried to get him to sign as an international. He wouldn't, because he wanted to get national designation. It was a very interesting story that Justin Dunk wrote. I hope you had a chance to check it out. But he's a guy that's jumped on the list for the first time ever, because he wasn't able to be on it. I don't know if you have the list in front of you, but is there anyone on this list? I don't know how much of the Combine you got to watch. Is anyone kind of on this list that kind of piqued your interest as a fan? Maybe a guy that the Ticats might be interested in taking?
Well, I look at the, you know, over the years, the offensive linemen always seem to go high in the draft. And there's a couple guys on here, you know, St. John from Oklahoma. I don't know if he has any NFL interest or not. I don't see, he might drop if he does. But there's a couple guys from Laval. You know, some big boys from Laval that could be drafted high. You know, like I said, the offensive linemen usually go in the top 10. So there could be a pair of Laval guys that go, you know, in the top 5 or the top 10. So, you know, and then there's a wide receiver that's number 2, Tavon Smith from Iowa, that, you know, I don't know much about him, but it's always interesting to see when you know, the positions like wide receiver or the so-called talent positions have high rankings in the draft. So those are just a couple guys that, you know, I don't know much about. I'm just kind of just talking for the podcast. I don't really know much about them. But, yeah, those are a couple guys.
I think I've said this on the show before. I think I said it last year going into the draft, that I'm a wide receiver whore. I love Canadian wide receivers. So I'm always hoping the Ticats will pick a couple guys. There's one guy on this list. He's near the bottom. He's number 19, and it's Levi Noel. And most people are probably thinking, like, why are you going down to the bottom of the list before you mention a player? And the reason I want him here, and this is a purely selfish reason, I watched him perform at the Combine, and he looked good, don't get me wrong, but he is a University of Toronto alum, and that's where I went to school. So the Ticats, as far as I know, have not had a U of T player on this roster for some time. I'd love it if they got one here, and I don't know how well he would contribute offensively. He'd probably have to make his hay on special teams like most young Canadians do. But give me the U of T kid. I really want to see the U of T kid in black and gold.
Yeah, then there's another wide receiver here in that number 10, Brian Jones from the East Coast, Acadia. It's from a small school, so you know, I spent some time on the East Coast, so I wouldn't mind seeing him in Ticats uniform as well. So there you go. And, you know, Mercer Timmons is, I recognize that name for the running back from Calgary. It's always good to see Canadian running backs coming up in the league, so maybe he makes an impact as well.
Well, and there's also, he's a Burlington kid, obviously. Everyone who had ever been to Iverwind Stadium knew that Brian Timmis Stadium was the soccer field that was adjacent to Iverwind. Mm-hmm. I believe Mercer is the grandson or great-grandson of Brian Timmis. Okay. So, again, there's a connection there. Dylan Guy is an offensive lineman from Buffalo who is from Hamilton. So there's another interesting connection. The one guy that kind of interests me outside of the offense is Taylor Loeffler, the defensive back from UBC. And I wonder if maybe he climbs up the Ticats board because of the injury to Craig Butler. Maybe we could see this guy. Number five, I think the Ticats picked fifth in this draft. Number five seems maybe a bit high for him. But again, maybe the Ticats draft based on need instead of, you know, best player available. And this is a need position. They have Mike Daly back there. They have Courtney Steven back there. And that's about it when it comes to guys that you'd be comfortable starting on defense. Loeffler looked really, really good in the drills at the Combine. He's one of the guys that, even though I don't know much about these guys, he's kind of stood out to me. So maybe that's a guy the Ticats could be targeting to fill in for Butler this year.
Yeah,
not necessarily as a starter, but you know, Daly becomes a starter and then Loeffler becomes the backup.
Yeah, because they got to get some backups, you know, for these guys to play behind them. They can't have Americans playing behind them because that would just, you know, if one of them goes down, then that messes up the ratio. So yeah, I could see them bringing in a Canadian DB for sure to be a backup, be a special teams player, all that stuff.
So that about stretched my knowledge about the incoming draft class as far as it could go. I think we've done better this year than we did last year, where I think we could reasonably say that we knew absolutely nothing. I think this year we were a little bit more knowledgeable. And again, like I said, hopefully we get a guest on next week before the draft that will just blow anything we could say out of the water, and we can pick his brain on guys at the Ticats or just who might go where and especially who the Ticats might take.
Yeah, you throw some knowledge at us.
Yeah, hopefully. So one last piece of news before we head into what I think will be the most divisive part of the show this week is the jerseys. The new jerseys made by Adidas will be unveiled on May 12th. New jerseys to me are always I feel two ways about them. It's exciting because you see if teams make wholesale changes, you get a new look and you wonder how people will respond. And I'm hoping the Ticats don't make too many major adjustments to the uniform they have. I like the jersey they have now. I wasn't too sold on it to begin with. I thought it was a lot of black. But if the Ticats are going to make a change, and this is just my personal preference, I would like the sleeves to be white. Go back to the Earl Winfield-like look. And I always use Earl because, you know, that's when I became a Ticat fan when in that late 80s, early 90s period, where they had the black chest and back piece and they had the white sleeves. I think that's a very sharp look. So if the Ticats make changes, and from what I understand, they have made some minor adjustments to the uniform, I hope that's the one they went with.
Yeah, that'd be cool, bringing back that vintage look. I understand that there have been some pretty big changes with some other teams. I heard that the Blue Bombers might be going back to their old uniforms, which I think is great. I think
the Royal Blues, that is happening. That's they've already announced that they're going back to that. I think that's a sharp look. I think it's perfect.
Yeah, I really like that look. I heard the BC Lions have had a drastic change. I don't know, you know, what exactly they'll look like, if they're getting rid of the orange or what they're doing, but I've heard some people tweet out that they're the sharpest of the bunch. So, and then I've heard, I think SJ Green tweeted out that he didn't like the Montreal uniforms at all. So, you know, I think we're gonna see some pretty big changes in a couple uniforms this year, and hopefully for the better. You know, I look at it two ways too. I think that, you know, maybe the CFL changes the jerseys a little bit too much, changes the uniforms a little bit too much. You know, hopefully this change lasts for a while. You know, hopefully they're not changing it up every 2 or 3 years, because that's what they've been doing in the recent past. So it's a bit of a money grab, and I get it. that they're doing it this year is because they're changing to Adidas, and hopefully it stays the same for years to come.
Well, that's part of my problem too, is that look at a team like Ottawa. They've been in the league 2 years, and now they're getting a brand new uniform. Like, I understand they've changed suppliers and they feel the need that they have to change the uniforms. When the NFL went from, I believe it was Reebok to Nike back in 2012, some teams changed their uniforms, but they didn't do changes for everybody. Like, the Oakland Raiders haven't changed their uniform in... Hell, ever. Dallas Cowboys have made tweaks here and there, but their uniforms stay the same. Same with the Green Bay Packers. Like, I don't understand this need to completely revamp the uniforms, and that's why I was kind of happy to hear that the Ticats made some minor adjustments. So, again, it is a cash grab, but I understand, you know, the league needs to make money, and fans are going to go out and buy these new jerseys in droves, and that's great. But, yeah, for a team like Ottawa, and I've made no bones about it, I don't really have much sympathy for Ottawa, but I feel for their fans in this, because they've gone out and they've spent a boatload of money on those uniforms, and if they make a bunch of drastic changes, like, that's a lot of money to be asking fans to part with so soon after the team just got back.
Yeah, for sure. It's a bit rough. I mean, I guess if you look at it the other way, the old uniforms are going on discount, so you can stock up on those.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, but it sucks, you know, if you have a jersey and it doesn't even look like the jersey on the field, then I could see a problem with that.
Yeah, I don't really care that much. I bought a couple of Ticats jerseys last year just because I wanted the signature jersey, because I know that they've been very, very divisive amongst fans, but I like the Ticats signature jersey with the gray, yeah. And I thought it looked pretty sharp. So I went out and picked myself up one of those, and they're apparently going to be done away with. So that won't be something that the team will be wearing. But I like it as just basically as a t-shirt, essentially. And it's not going to stop me from wearing it. And like the changes in Winnipeg, those are the changes fans have been clamoring for.
Yeah, so give the fans what they want, you know?
Yeah, like they're out there going, like, we want the Royal Blues back. So they're going to get what they want. So they're not going to be too upset. I just worry about some of the changes other teams will make that maybe – like, you know, Saskatchewan fans are going to buy whatever you put you slap an S on anything out there, and the fans out there will purchase it. And I just feel bad for the fans who want to feel like they're on the cutting edge and maybe can't afford to get the new uniforms or what have you. But yeah, to me, it's a minor quibble, but it's just something I don't really like to see.
Yeah, for sure.
The other thing that kind of I find weird about this is the date. They're unveiling these jerseys 2 days after the draft, and I know they're going to do this big, like, star-studded gala presentation out in Montreal, and that's great because it's going to be something where the league is showcasing itself and all other sorts of stuff. But doesn't it seem a little silly to you for them not to have just unveiled the jerseys maybe a little bit earlier and then used the kind of the draft as the launching point for these new uniforms? Because sometimes we see players, not all the time because the draft isn't held where in like a giant stadium where all the people show up, but sometimes you'll see the pictures taken with the player signs his contract, he's wearing the hat, he's got the jersey there. They do that with this year, and 2 days later, those jerseys are going to be obsolete. It just seems a little silly that they couldn't have sort of melded this together a little bit better.
Yeah, they, you know, why do it 2 days after? Why not, you know, a couple days before or the day of? It just, yeah, it doesn't really make sense. You know, they could have planned that a little bit better. So, you know, why not have the new jersey? If I know the first overall pick isn't always there with the team, you know, to show off the hat and the jersey. But if he is, like, why not have the new jersey on hand and the new logo or whatever to slap on the new draft pick?
Yeah, and again, these are just minor things that we're quibbling about here. I don't think I don't have a problem with what they're doing necessarily. I just think there's a few missteps, maybe, is the best way to put it. I just kind of find it a little silly, but we're going to get new jerseys in about 2 weeks' time, and we'll probably be on the show here talking about which ones we liked, which ones we didn't, and we'll have some fun with that.
Yeah, for sure. I'm excited for it.
Yeah, speaking of having a little fun, so this week I decided, kind of unilaterally, but you also agreed when I sent you the request, that we were going to do away with the questions this week. In the last little while, we've seen a lot of people, most notably Rod Peterson, make these what I have called way too early predictions. And they've taken a lot of heat for it. I kind of like taking heat sometimes. So I figured, like, maybe this would be a kind of fun thing to do. Now, I can't stress enough that these are not our formal predictions. Mike and I will make our set in stone, etched in tablet predictions come right before the start of the regular season. This, to me, is just a fun little thing that we can do to kind of, you know, maybe rile up some chatter or what have you. So, Mike, as things stand right now, with all the movements that we've seen and all the coaching movements and player movements and everything that we've seen so far, where do you see the order of finish and how the playoffs are going to fall? Let's start in the West Division. What is your 1-5 in the West as of right now?
All right. So, okay, this might be a shocker to you and others, but I got the Bombers, the X, the Stampeders, the Rough Riders, and the Lions, 1-5.
I'm sorry, did you say the Bombers at number one?
Yes, I said the Bombers.
I'm glad these are not the ones we're setting in stone, because that is, holy moly, that's us. So what is the reason for your faith in Winnipeg right now?
I just feel that I think I like the moves they made in the offseason. I think that they're on the brink of really breaking through, obviously, because I picked them first. And I just like Drew Willey. I think that he's a really good quarterback that could be a great quarterback if he gets protection, if he has the talent around him, which I think he does now. Receivers-wise, offensive line-wise, I think they could be a really potent offense. And I think they're going to be a big shocker this year. A really good regular season. So that's my reasoning. I think that Mike O'Shea is a good coach. I think that he's, you know, had some tough breaks. I think that he's been a victim of the past GMs, talent-wise. You know, he had to go through a long rebuilding phase, and I think that they're on the brink of really doing something great.
Holy smokes. Okay, so you had Winnipeg 1. Recap the rest of the list just so I can remember.
Just because you're so shocked.
That was the rest. I was just kind of like, I know you had BC in fifth, but hearing Winnipeg first, I was kind of stunned for a second there. It took me a second. What was the rest again?
Edmonton second, Calgary third, and Saskatchewan fourth, BC fifth.
Okay, I'm kind of wishing now I would have made my predictions first, because mine are kind of boring compared to yours. Yours are, wow, that Winnipeg one, man. I wonder where you're going to have the Bombers come the start of the regular season when we make our legit picks, because that's hey, you know what? You got to go out there sometimes, and I got to give you some respect, some major respect for putting your cojones on the line. And you're gonna hear from a few people, probably a few people out in Saskatchewan, and probably a few people from where you are right now, who are going to question your sanity for making the Bombers number one. But so mine were, again, these are kind of boring. I got Calgary first, I got Edmonton second, I got the Riders in third, I got the Bombers fourth, and we agree on the Lions in fifth. What is it about BC that you don't really see as being a team that will make, because they were a playoff team last year and they bring back Wally Buono, who is an established head coach, and what is it about them that you kind of don't see as the reasons why they'll be a playoff team come 2016?
I question if Wally Buono still has what it takes to be a head coach, a successful head coach in this league. I know that he's been one of the best, if not the best, in CFL history on the sidelines, but I just wonder if the game's kind of passed him by. In the past he didn't wear a headset. I don't know if that's a huge deal or not, but like, you know, you got to get with the times. If he's not going to wear a headset, then it might be trouble. If the game's passing by, it might be trouble. And they got Jonathan Jennings as quarterback, and yes, he played well last year, but we've seen a lot of quarterbacks have success in short stints and then really take a nosedive when they get the chance to be starters. So, you know, I think that, yes, they were a playoff team, but then they got smoked in the first round in the semifinals. So I think that this team is going to have to take a couple more years to just rebuild. And, you know, I think they're going to have a tough time this season. You got Alamimian coming back, and you don't know if he's the same player. You don't know if he's the top-notch player. You don't know. You know, they were aging secondary last year, and they made a lot of changes. So, you know, those are just some of the reasons why I think that BC is going to take a big nosedive.
Those are all valid criticisms and all things I agree with. My big thing is, you look at BC since Wally stepped down as head coach. They won the Grey Cup in 2011. Since then, the team's record has gotten worse and worse, and their talent has gotten worse and worse. And it makes me wonder if Buono has lost his touch talent-wise. Yes, he finds guys like Jonathan Jennings, but like you said, we've seen guys come in here, light the world on fire, and then come back for that second season, and they're out of the league by the third. Mm-hmm. So can he recapture the magic he had last year, and can he build going forward? I hope he can, because he's an exciting player, and I think the more exciting players we have in this league, the better the league is. But yeah, I can see BC taking a step back this year before they take that step. If Jennings is the guy, before they take that step up in a couple of years. So we're going to go to the East now. I think we poured over the West enough. Oh, before we go, who are your playoff teams from the West?
Got the first three, Bombers, Esks, Calgary.
Okay. Now, I'm going to start in the East because I don't know what your predictions are, but again, I don't think there's going to be much shock, even though I think I'm going to take a little bit of heat of this simply because of the team that I cheer for. But I have the Argos finishing first in the East this year. I got Hamilton in second. I got Ottawa third and Montreal fourth. What's your form order for the East Division this year?
Well, I got, you know, I'm going to be the homer here. I got Hamilton first, Toronto second, Ottawa third, Montreal fourth. I think that, you know, maybe Hamilton starts off a little rocky because Claros might not be there. And, you know, Condell, we talked about it earlier, but I think they'll get on track and it'll be tight. I think that maybe it'll just be a one-game difference between Hamilton and Toronto for that first-place spot. But yeah, that's the order I got it. Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal.
Okay, so the reason I put Toronto first, because I think Toronto and Hamilton are neck and neck. And the reason I put the Argos first is I think they're going to start the season better and build up a bit of a lead on the rest of the division because they got the new home. They're relatively healthy. And the difference between Toronto and Hamilton to me is the health at quarterback. I know that Ricky Ray has not exactly been the model of consistency and health the last few years, but I got to think that after basically a year off, he's going to be back and healthy and ready to go. I have a ton of confidence in Milanovic to coach him up. They should not have been as good as they were last year. They won 10 games last year, and that was a team in turmoil. They had like five legit home games. It was a mess. I think with a steady schedule, with a lot more stability in that organization, I think we're going to see exactly how good they can be. If they can accomplish what they've accomplished the last few years with all the upheaval, imagine what they can do when they have some continuity. And I think that that early season is what's going to separate the two. I think once Caleros comes back, I think Hamilton starts to go on a roll. But I think the Argos will have built up enough of a lead. Probably winning that first game at BMO against the Ticats will be the difference. They play three times this year, twice in Toronto, once in Hamilton. I think that the Argos having home field in those games will be the difference. I see maybe either a one-game difference between the two, or they have the same record, but the Argos win the head-to-head. That, to me, is going to be the difference between those two. Ottawa, I've talked about. I think they're going to suffer a major fall-off. And Montreal, I think, as long as Jim Popp is the head coach, I don't really think there's really much to talk about there.
Yeah, you make some good points about Toronto, you know, and then you got, you know, a huge improvement over the defensive coordinator last year. You know, you bring in Rich Stubler, he has a ton of experience. So that defense is going to be better. You know, like you said, Ricky Ray's back and healthy. He's gonna probably light up the league again. So, yeah, I see Toronto as a very strong team as well. You know, it's so tough with these predictions. I have Montreal on last, but I think that they could be a lot better this year with some of the talent they brought in with Kevin Glenn behind center. So, you know, it's just so tough. You know, and Ottawa is going to drop down, I think, because of all the talent they've lost on the defensive line. I think that that's going to affect their whole defense. You know, you're not getting as much pressure on the quarterback. That's going to hurt, you know, obviously the defensive line and the secondary. The secondary is going to have to cover more. They're going to, you know, the receivers are going to have more time to get open. So I think that Ottawa's offense will still be really good, but I think their defense is going to take a little bit of a drop. So that's going to put them down to third place in the East, in my opinion.
Okay, so your three West, just to recap, your three West playoff teams were Winnipeg, Edmonton, Calgary, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so mine in the West are Calgary, Edmonton, Saskatchewan. Who are your three playoff teams from the East?
Hamilton, Toronto, Ottawa.
Okay, so I have Toronto, Hamilton, and in the crossover, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. That's why I asked, because like obviously the top three teams make the playoffs, but I think the Bombers could get to like that 9-win mark and do enough to cross over. I really do think Ottawa is going to have a drastic fall off. And I think the Bombers will do enough to squeak into the playoffs and get that East semifinal. So your West semifinal then is Calgary at Edmonton. Who do you got in that one?
I'm going to say Edmonton's going to prevail in that one.
Yeah, I have Edmonton over Saskatchewan myself. Your East semifinal would then be Ottawa at Toronto. Who do you got there?
Toronto.
All right, so I have Hamilton over Winnipeg. That makes your West Division final, the Edmonton Eskimos at the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. Who is your West representative in the Grey Cup as of right now?
Bombers.
Wow, I really thought you'd have the upset and take the Esks there. Just because I was thinking, oh, he's going to take Edmonton. They have the, you know, championship pedigree. But you got the Bombers going to the Grey Cup. My West Division final is Edmonton at Calgary. And I'm going chalk and I'm taking the Calgary Stampeders to get back to the Grey Cup. So that means your East Division final is the one. We both have the same East Division final. It's Hamilton, Toronto, QEW. Who you got?
I
got
to go Hamilton. Got to go Hamilton. Hamilton, the Grey Cup again, gets back after a year absence.
So your Grey Cup is Hamilton, Winnipeg. One of the classic Grey Cups. They battled a ton in the 1960s. Yes. That's a very classic Grey Cup. I am about to say something that is going to piss off, I would guess, 99% of our listenership. I have got the Toronto Argonauts beating the Hamilton Tiger Cats in the East Division Final, which makes my Grey Cup Toronto in Toronto against the Calgary Stampeders, a rematch of the 100th Grey Cup in 2012. So, your Grey Cup, Hamilton, Winnipeg, who are you taking?
Hamilton.
No surprise there. And if I pissed them off, if I didn't piss people off with the last pick, I'm sure as hell going to piss them off here. I got the Argos winning the Grey Cup right now.
Ooh, back-to-back Grey Cup wins at home for the Argos.
Yeah, I just look at that team, and we have spent a lot of this offseason fluffing them to no extent. Like, I have just been so impressed with the moves that they have made that as much as it pains me to say, as of right now, with everything being equal, I got the Argos. I went back and forth. Calgary, and then I just kept going, they're at home, man. They're at home. God damn it, the Argos are going to take this again. Mm-hmm. And there's no, like, Ricky Ray cloud hanging over the team. There's no, oh, they traded, the league made this happen. Mm-hmm. Like we heard before. No, I just, right now, I think the Argos are going to take it. And I say that through very, very gritted teeth.
Yeah, well, I respect you for, you know, picking the Argos to win, because I know it's not easy for Tiger Cats fan to predict a Grey Cup win for the Argos. But, you know, I don't think you're crazy. I think that the Argos are going to be a very good team next year. And I think it's a big possibility that they not only make it to the Grey Cup, but win it. So kudos to you, sir.
So we still have 2 months, a little less than 2 months before the season starts, and a lot of things can change then. If I'll say it right now, if Zach Caleros is deemed healthy to start the season, that puts this entire prediction thing in upheaval. But I thought it would be fun to kind of put these out there, and I don't think we did anything too controversial. I should take that back. You putting Winnipeg first is really good. It's really going to surprise some people. But you know what? All in good fun, and that's what this is all about. I tried to put my, and I think I did a good job of putting the homerish thoughts aside. I tried to look at this as objectively as possible, and I think you did too. I'm not saying that you pick Hamilton to win there for your homer, but I think you made some valid reasons why the Ticats obviously can win the Grey Cup, and I think they will be in the conversation all season long. But yeah, as of right now, I got the Argos.
Yeah, well, you know, things can change. You know, maybe I'll lighten up on the Bombers and put them down a bit, but you know, we shall see how training camp. You know, we'll see their final rosters, and right before the season starts, we'll give another official set in stone prediction.
For sure. So that's it then for this week. As always, don't forget that you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you're not an iTunes subscriber, you can get the episode on podbean.com or by downloading the Podbean app onto your mobile device. I don't know how many people do that, but I know people have asked in the past about non-iTunes ways to get it. There's your way. Get the app, download it that way, then you got it. We didn't ask any questions this week, but that doesn't mean we won't in the future. So if you have a question you want Mike or I or both of us to give our opinions on, you can always hit us up on Twitter. Mike, your Twitter handle as always, buddy?
Mike_Ticats.
And I am Josh Smith_82. And as always, post those comments and those questions in the 3Down Nation comment section when the post goes up. We call from those and then pick some good ones. So for Podski Wee Wee this week, I am Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.